Hello and welcome. My name is Kyle, and this is How You Level Up, a podcast that decodes language to help you become your best self. Today, we're going to be speaking with Carlos Garcia. He is a JAG officer and a master resilience trainer in the Army Reserve. For over a decade, he's worked as a trial defense counsel and resilience trainer, helping soldiers and leaders tackle judgment and adversity head on. One of the very difficult things that we all experience is maintaining composure under pressure. Very often, we have a story that we tell ourselves. Carlos helps his clients, both in the military and outside of the military, to identify what that story is so that you can make a conscious choice about how you're going to react to a certain situation, or perhaps just to understand a little bit more about yourself. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I'm sure you will too. Without further ado, here's the conversation that I had with Carlos Garcia. You were in the military, and you were a JAG officer. My brother's actually was a JAG officer as well, so I have a little bit of context in terms of what you were handling. Let's start off with that point in your story when you were working for the military.
Sure. So where, what branch was your brother?
In the Marine Corps.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, I probably should have done the Marine Corps. You know, in the Marine Corps, JAGs are considered paper pushers. They're not really JAGs. That's what they call them, right? I don't know if your brother told you that. You're always a Marine first and then a JAG second. Absolutely. And I think you were in the JAG as well, in the Marine Corps as well, right?
I was, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm in the Army Reserve JAG Corps. So there's an active duty component and a reserve component. And I commissioned in 2016. Into the Army Reserves, into the Army JAG Corps Reserves, and I've been doing it ever since, and I love it. You know, I'm a major now in the Reserves, and I work in TDS, which stands for Trial Defense Service, and essentially it's sort of like being a public defender on the civilian side, except, you know, in the military you're defending soldiers, and with different sort of adverse actions, different sort of crimes. And it's sort of neat because you can change branches in the legal fields that you're in. You can work in international law, you can work in criminal law, ad law, environmental law. But I really love trial defense service because I like this notion of working for the underdog. You know, it's like the whole government is against you. That's just like in the public defender civilian side. It's very similar on the military side. And I love that. You know, I love the part about having to really connect with an individual and having to humanize them, essentially, right? Because many times when the charges come all the way up the chain of command, all they see is a piece of paper. So part of my job is to humanize the individual who's being charged with whatever he's being charged with, or she. And that entails a lot of getting to know the soldier as an individual, as a human being. Where do they come from? Who are they? Who were their parents, or who are their parents? Hobbies, passions, etc. And really getting an intimate look into their lives, because it's so important when you go up to separation boards, for example, and you have to talk to the judges, essentially, and explain who this person is, that he's just not a piece of paper. You know, he's a human, and this is why certain things happened, in providing context, because there's always context that you have to include, circumstances surrounding the situations. So yeah, that's sort of what I do with trial defense, and I've been doing it for a while now. I love it.
Yeah, almost 10 years at this point.
Yeah, right. Wow. 10 years. Yeah, time flies. Yeah. So
when you're humanizing someone, there is, of course, you know, when you join the military, you become a number. You become the property of the U.S. government. I think that's legally what you become, right? And that's why they don't want you to do certain things, you know, take any sort of legal drugs. There's different regulations and laws that apply to anyone that's in the military And learning about that context for the individual, how do you then relay that to the judge? How is it you get their story across?
Yeah, it's a lot having to do with immersing yourself in the experiences of the person, you know, because it's very different when you prepare, say you're preparing for a presentation. So in my case, I have to do opening statements and closing statements and, you know, oral advocacy. And it's not, I have found in my experience, it's not just about memorizing the script. You have to really invoke and believe in what you say. You have to really immerse yourself in the experiences that your client had. From you have to see things from their point of view. It almost like experience it so that you can really feel, you know, like you can really associate emotions with it, so that when it's time to deliver and advocate for your client, it's going to come out naturally. You don't have to think about, you know, raising your hands like this or using vocal variety or, you know, making sure your facial expressions or your body gestures are on point, because it's coming from your inside, right? You've internalized the experiences. And when you do that, in my experience, I found that everything else comes more naturally. You look more persuasive.
Yeah.
You look more persuasive and you sound more persuasive. I don't know if you can resonate with that.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're not overthinking whatever is the points you're getting across. You're just relaying the information in the most transparent and authentic way. And you can't do that unless you truly understand.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's about just immersing yourself and wanting to do it as well. Because if you're not really understanding where your client is coming from, it's just going to be a memorization sort of exercise, and you're going to start thinking about, okay, what do I say now, versus trying to get, you know, speaking with more intent,
yeah,
or purpose,
right?
Yeah, and that for me has made a big difference.
You have the ability to choose your clients outside of your JAG work. Is there any optionality for you to choose who you represent when representing them as a JAG officer?
Yeah, that's a good question. So nowadays, I do my JAG work as an attorney, and then I don't really take any clients on the civilian side. But yeah, I mean, I think what you're asking is about conflict of interest, right?
Conflict of interest, or partly, you know, wanting and understanding their point of view. I mean, there's definitely people that you want to work with and people maybe you don't want to work with, but you still have to advocate for them.
For sure, yeah. So if I was to work in criminal defense work on the civilian side, which I don't, but I know many people who do, one challenge is dealing with people who are not necessarily fun to work with. For various reasons, they're not good keeping the communication lines open. They're not good in giving information requested from the attorneys. And that, just those two factors, complicates things tremendously and creates a lot of time inefficiencies. Yeah, nowadays what I do is I train, so I'm an Army resilience trainer. I'm sure in the Marine Corps you have something similar, right? Every branch has something similar, like a master resilience training program. Mm-hmm. You have that as well, right? Yeah. So in the Army we have something like this. It's called MRT, stands for Master Resilience Trainer. And several years ago, a psychologist and his team by the name of Martin Seligman came and created this program. And the Army, in conjunction with Martin Seligman and his team, they worked together to create a resilience training program that was initially being used on the civilian side, but then the Army adopted it, and they created this program that essentially trained soldiers in different units on resilience topics, how to become more resilient, how to increase your resilience. And then soldiers who are trained in resilience, they become certified resilience trainers. And then they go to their respective units and they train the soldiers in their respective units. And so that's what I do. And I go to my unit and I train. And it's challenging because on the reserve side, not everybody meets all the time. So the challenge is always, how do you inculcate these important topics to soldiers who only see you a certain amount of time, right? And even on the active duty side, I wish it was a little bit more prioritized in terms of blocking out chunks of time to really learn this stuff, because often I've found that resilience training is not prioritized like it should be, but I think it's super important. There's a perception in the military about resilience, but I think it's important to understand that, you know, resilience for me and how I define it is about bouncing back, being flexible, but not just bouncing back, but thriving in the face of adversity, in the face of uncertainty, in the face of change. And underneath that requires lots of emotional control. And that means that emotions, if you think about it, what ultimately derails us often are our emotions, right? Frustration, anger, impatience, stress, anxiety, fear. And if we don't know how to control that, then we're going to quit early. We're not going to try. We're going to avoid things. And a lot of resilience is emotional control, knowing how to manage your thoughts, knowing how to manage your emotions, knowing what to tell yourself after you fail or after you make a mistake. Because if you don't know what to tell yourself, you're gonna stay down, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to stay down too long.
Yeah. Yeah. The knowing of what to tell yourself. There's distinctions that inside of this resilience training you likely have in your toolkit of, this is what you can say to feel a little bit better. This is what you can look for in your emotional reaction to identify what is it that you're feeling, so you can figure out, why am I feeling this, right? That emotional control, even the word control, it's very militarized in the sense of it's intelligence to understand what's happening. And you're completely right. In the military, they instead of acknowledging whatever emotions are happening, they say, you don't have emotions, you're strong, you are a weapon, go out, fight the good fight, and then come back and you'll be fine. Whereas this resilience recognition, it's, hold on, if you're feeling something, let's figure out what it is so we can move past it and through it rather than avoiding it completely.
Yeah, we have this perception that we should avoid our emotions or hide them, but doing that makes, you know, it's going into your subconscious, but it's going to bubble up when you least expect it, I have found, and research shows as well. And so you need to, so there's a therapy that is considered a very highly effective form of therapy, which is, you may have heard of, it's called exposure therapy or stress desensitization. And that's what the military actually does, which is doing things that are increasingly difficult and stressful, and then over time desensitizing yourself to the stress, right? So if you think about training for actual missions, right, like in the Marine Corps or special or operators, you know, Navy SEALs, that's how they train. Olympians, that's how they train. They train for the mission, where the training becomes more difficult than the actual mission, so that when the mission comes, they're ready, right? They're ready to shine. And there's a reason behind that, because by making the training highly difficult, you're desensitizing yourself to the stress, because when it's time to shine, you need to be able to think clearly. You need to be able to be creative, use your intuition, think on your feet. And I have found that you can't do that if you're feeling highly anxious or highly stressed out, because your amygdala is going crazy, right? That fight or flight response. You need to train your amygdala by teaching it through stress exposure that there's nothing to fear. And over time, your amygdala calms down so it doesn't get activated, and your prefrontal cortex part, the thinking part of your brain, can actually do the thinking, right? And be creative. And that requires, just like the military trains, which is a great way to train, I think a very effective way of training for anything, even in the workplace. You know, like, many people make the mistake of training their communication or negotiation skills or their public speaking skills at the workplace. But you don't necessarily want to learn those things or take such high risks in the workplace, because you need to be able to shine in the workplace. And you have a certain persona you need to keep, right? You have a reputation. And so you can train for these things outside the workplace, right? So if you have a fear of public speaking, you can train for these things outside of the workplace by mimicking the environment and expressing yourself essentially in public speaking scenarios, so that you bring that new experience and new confidence into the workplace, right? Or negotiations, for example. If you need to do a lot of pitches, if you're an investor, an entrepreneur, and you have, you know, you want to negotiate with some good potential prospects that you have, you don't want to blow it, right? So you want to make sure that you adequately prepare. How do you do that? Not by doing it in real life, but doing it in other ways that mimics that stress level, so that when it's time to do it, it's easier. You're not so stressed.
It's the same.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's the same thing that you're doing when you're preparing to defend someone. It's getting to know what's happening inside and out. So you're preparing for that negotiation. You got to know everything ahead of time. It has to be like the back of your hand. You know exactly all of the details so that you can then move with the flow of the negotiation or public speaking. I think exposure therapy in general is a well-known topic, and I don't think a lot of people know how to do it, how to prepare for it, even if they think to themselves, oh, like, okay, I have a presentation, and so let me present to my friend, or let me present to three friends over Zoom. Nobody's taking that step to do the preparation of, let me call up three of my friends, right, or text them and say, hey, can you hop on a Zoom? I'm going to do a bullshit presentation for you, but it's really important for me.
Yeah, I think just rehearsing or recording yourself, it's not enough, I found, in my experience. You have to actually feel some adrenaline, because it's easy when you can be your best self when you record yourself, right? That's great. But when you have eyeballs on you, it's a completely different story, right? Because we have this tendency to worry too much about what people think. And when we do that, we're worrying, i.e. it's creating anxiety. And when we're feeling anxious, we can't think clearly, right? And so really it's about being calm under pressure. And I have found that the way to be calm under increasing pressure is to feel the pressure, right? Sit in the anxiety, which is what exposure is, and realizing that there's nothing to fear, essentially. I say essentially a lot. I gotta stop saying essentially.
That's okay. I feel as though, and if I could jump in, I feel as though this is a good bridge for the True Progress Lab, where this is something that you're attempting to help people achieve. Building resilience outside of the military, right? This is more for civilians. Can you talk about the mission of the True Progress Lab and then maybe some of the tools that you're providing to clients?
Yeah. So the mission is get calm, get bold, and then get after it. And to get after it means to be able to seize opportunities and not let your ambition be quenched unconsciously or consciously by your emotions. And the way you do that, I found, is by learning how to remain calm in situations that stress you out. And once you learn how to remain calm and think clearly, then you can start to expand your capacity for risk-taking and boldness, courage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can actually start getting after it. So in that order, right?
Yeah.
And the way I do that is by putting people through an experiential journey where they undergo identity expanding experiences that help create proof of their capabilities, evidence, by going through experiences that stress them in an increasing level. So we have two avenues for that. We make them go through physical conditioning training and mental conditioning. Physical conditioning is about engaging in physical rigorous activity, whether it's running or rowing or strength training, because I found that using your body is a perfect vehicle for learning how to train your mind, mm-hmm. i.e. learning how to manage counterproductive thoughts and emotions from getting in the way of doing what you know you need to do, even though you don't want to do them. Because physical training helps to remove variables like other human beings, where it's just you and your shoes and the road you have to run on, and learning how to manage your emotions. And the way we help them do that too is by giving them techniques and protocols that are an aid for them to use. Ultimately, you want to decrease the number of tools you have in managing your thoughts and emotions, because they can also become safety behaviors. You can over rely on emotion regulation techniques, and in effect you're trying to get rid of the anxiety, when in reality you're supposed to sit in the anxiety and teach yourself that it's going to be okay, right? So, and then we have mental conditioning exercises. And that consists of getting creative in terms of mimicking the situations that trigger the anxiety for people, whether it's public speaking, whether it's difficult conversations, giving feedback, networking, being in the spotlight as a leader, leading meetings. And we get pretty creative with that, which is very effective as well, our intentional embarrassment training. And that sort of thing consists of putting yourself in potentially embarrassing situations.
Do you have an example I need to know?
Yeah, like going into a restaurant and asking the manager if you can take a look at in their kitchen before you order something. Or going into Starbucks and making an announcement that, you know, you're a awkward and socially anxious person, you know, because, and, you know, things like that. And, what I found is that it's a highly effective form of, exposure therapy, by the way, as well. It's they call it different things. I think they also call it, same attack exercises. But essentially what you want, because if you think about it, what we fear often is it's the people looking at us and judging us. It's the fear of being negatively judged or evaluated, because we have this innate desire of being liked,
mm-hmm.
right? But we take that to an extreme where we modify our decisions, we modify our actions to a point where we do things to be liked. We don't want to be disliked. and we fear making mistakes in public because we fear retribution of, okay, they're going to judge me if I fail. So what happens is that we start people-pleasing, we start staying in our comfort zone. Mm-hmm. We only do things that confirms our competence and shy away from things that will be potentially risky for us, where we might potentially fail, right? And that requires a mindset shift. You know, a lot of people I help, like myself, you know, I was a take myself too seriously. I'm a recovering take myself too seriously guy. And when you do that, you're trying to upkeep or maintain a persona or image vis-a-vis other people. And that can be very exhausting, right? Yeah. Instead of focusing on learning, instead of focusing on being okay with making mistakes, because to learn, you have to make mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. And laughing at yourself on the way down as you make mistakes, being okay with looking silly and looking foolish. I think you have to adopt that mindset. And instead of trying to maintain this persona, because it is exhausting, right?
Yeah.
To maintain a persona, it's exhausting.
I think that I'm finding myself, as you're saying this, definitely falling into the bucket of, I either take myself too seriously, or it's the other side, which is, I'm a complete goofball, and I don't care about anything or anyone's opinion, and I don't always know what's triggering me to flip between the two. There's of course going to be a middle ground I should be walking. If I was to be one of your clients at True Progress Lab, how would you work with me through that? Because I would like to also be a recovering person from taking myself too seriously.
Yeah, you have to start with like low level challenges, you know, and understand and change your definition. By the way, just a side note, do you know MBTI?
No.
The MBTI? No, okay. It's a personality assessment. It's a personality assessment that tells you what your stress triggers are and your natural inclinations in terms of how you think and communicate. But it's interesting when you said that there are times when you take yourself too seriously and times when you're a goofball, because I sort of identify myself like that as well. Like, I'll be super serious to the point where people will think that I'm like just a standoffish, serious guy. Other times I'll be a complete goofball. And so that's interesting. You might be, you should look it up on, you know, after the episode. You might be an INTJ, because that's what I am. But anyway, so the first thing would be, you know, one of the first things is changing your definition of what failure means. Mm-hmm. Right? Getting really clear with that. Failure does not equal failure. Failure does not confirm your competence. Failure is just a data point, not a confirmation point. And starting with low-level discomfort challenges where you start to realize that, okay, this is okay, right? Like, I'm winning, I'm succeeding in these challenges, I'm putting myself out there, and it's okay. And then failing as well, increasing the stress level where you're actually failing, and then knowing what to tell yourself after you fail. So reiterating the fact that this is going to be okay, this is part of the process. It's A lot of it is changing. In the beginning, I found people's definitions of what things mean. It gets as basic as that, because they come in often. People, you know, they come with this persona and they have this definition, like, I have to succeed, I have to succeed. But they don't realize that no, you don't have to succeed. What you need to do is put in the reps and desensitize yourself to failure, essentially, right? They need to understand that failure is part of the process and that failure is okay. It means you're learning. So, and we do that just through reps, putting in the reps.
I might go into a Starbucks and make some proclamation in the near future. I'm not going to be bringing my wife, though, because it will embarrass her to death.
No, I do it once I try to do like every, I would say every 2 to 3 weeks, I try to do something just completely humiliating. Like last time I went into a Target and, you know, I asked some people, random people, to hold my phone while I sing some songs, some kid songs. And the other time I asked some people to take pictures of me while I was modeling on the floor.
Oh my God.
Like just in the aisles, you know? Yeah. And just things like that, you know? And you have like a memory, you can look at your phone and you'd be like, oh, I did that. No, but on a serious note, it helps you loosen up, you know? It helps you loosen up and not take yourself too seriously. Like you're not this serious robot. You're a human being. You got to keep things playful.
Yeah.
You know, you got to keep things playful. And it's a way to, when you do these challenges, I've found that you expand your perspective of on what's possible, on what you can do. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can do humility, things like that, you can probably do other things. And it keeps that playful mind so that you can be creative and think about things. Because I feel like when you expand your self-perception, you expand your perception of what's possible, and therefore you're expanding your thinking, your creativity. You're thinking about things that you didn't think about before. So it's a creative exercise as well.
Yeah. I want to loop this.
Wouldn't you agree?
I completely agree with you. And I can't help but notice this humiliating performance and application. This, along with the strength training or the body training, this feels like such a distinction that separates True Progress Lab from other organizations when trying to reach a level of self-development that your client is seeking. There's not a lot of organizations who will focus on the physical part. They might do, you know, if they were an officer, a JAG officer, for example, they might do mock trials, right? But the humiliating part, the physical part, these are big distinctions. Looking at the five ways that True Progress Lab functions, the Inner Fortress program, the Inner Fortress for Teams, Endurance OS, True Progress is a newsletter as well, and then Daily Tips and Insights, these five different things, when we look at them, is all of that included? The physical, the mental preparation, the humiliation exercises, is that all inside of the Inner Fortress program?
Yeah, so the Inner Fortress program, great question. The Inner Fortress program is my flagship program. So that's the physical and the mental conditioning. The Enduro OS, that's more on productivity, where I help attorneys get organized, because as you may or may not know, attorneys are highly unorganized. But the Inner Fortress program, the physical conditioning, I found is super important, because it's not just about being good at your job. Because mm-hmm. often people identify themselves with their job. You know, their confidence comes mainly from their job. Yeah. But if you really want to shine in situations, in times of uncertainty where you don't have all of the control, you need to bring confidence from other areas of your life that are not just your job. You need to push yourself physically. You need to create proof that you're a badass, right? Mm-hmm. Like anybody who works out or pushes themselves physically, they create proof that they can do hard things, right? Not just be a good lawyer, a highly intelligent analytical lawyer, or a successful doctor. I mean, people who are good at communicating, I think, are good at communicating not because they use fancy tactical language, but because they bring there's this aura about them that is internal. And that aura comes from having certain experiences that teaches them that they're able to do difficult things.
Yeah.
Which is why you're work out as well, right? You don't work out to you know, the looking good is a side benefit, right? But it, you know, I'm sure you can relate.
Yeah.
In terms of the reasons why you push yourself.
Yeah. The more
physically.
Yeah. The more strenuous my exercise is, the calmer I also feel throughout the day. Mm. It sets the tone almost. And in my personal experience, I actually injured my back at some point. I'm unsure when. And when I was in a lot of pain a number of years ago and was trying to figure out what the pain was coming from, it definitely took a hit. My confidence took a hit because I wasn't pushing myself. I wasn't working out. All of a sudden, I couldn't lift above a certain weight and put it on my shoulders to squat it, or you know, I couldn't do certain workouts. Like, I haven't done a crunch in 6 years just because that movement hurts me a couple of days later as my body is healing, as my muscles are healing. So, you know, throughout time and learning how I can work my abs without actually doing a crunch laying on the ground, that then gives me the confidence to go, okay, well, I overcame that. I can overcome something else. And then, yeah, it's nice to look good. A nice perk to working out.
Yeah. Yeah. You definitely feel calmer, you know, because it's, I don't particularly like to work out. I don't know if you do, but you know, we're like going to the gym or working out. You know, there are times when I don't want to do it. And I found that when I do it after the fact, you feel like you've really accomplished something. You overcame that internal dialogue where your thoughts were trying to get the best of you, mm-hmm. and by telling you not to work out. And so that's a rep.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a rep. And teaching yourself to do things you don't want to do, but you know you have to get to your objective.
The sigh that you just did, it feels as though you were thinking about a thing you didn't want to do in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it's... So I also practice judo. I'm an avid judo player. Okay. And I've been doing that for about 5 years. And it's I like it to do it, but there are times when I just don't want to do it because it's hard. But I found that every time I do it, I feel much better afterwards. Like I really accomplished something. Yeah, and I would encourage everybody to do something physically difficult, whether it's a marathon or a ultra marathon or a combat sport or martial art. It's I think the world would be a calmer place.
Yeah.
You know, we would all be kind of in a zen mode, just improving our relationships with one another. Because we have all this internal baggage inside of us as we're going along our day, and people don't have an outlet to release that. And, you know, you get into road rage, you shut down, you go into your corner, or you're physically present, but you're not fully engaged. And when you exercise, I found, you combat that. It helps in addressing those things.
Yeah.
So that you become calm and then you can actually be engaged.
Yeah. So. There's a big difference between athletes and non-athletes. And that's not to say that non-athletes, those who aren't finding the time to push themselves physically, aren't also extremely resilient. They can find resilience in other ways, but it's a really simple way to move your body, to check off that first box of, okay, I did a workout, now what does the day have for me? Because I'd like to tackle it.
Completely agree, yeah. Completely agree with that, yeah.
For True Progress Lab, what does a client intake look like? Who is it that's reaching out to you most often and seeking your guidance, your expertise?
It's a combination of entrepreneurs, attorneys, managers, leaders in different industries, really, who come with a problem and they think they have this problem regarding some sort of anxiety, but they can't really pinpoint it. And we do an assessment and ask them some questions. And the more open they can be, the better for us, right? And the anxiety is really consuming, because often people don't want to admit to having anxiety. They just know they have some anxiety.
They're almost judging themselves, thinking that they're weak for having anxiety when it's just a natural thing to feel.
Right. Exactly. Right. And they're almost ashamed to admit it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the first things we do is like, okay, understanding emotions are a tool. They tell you things, mm-hmm. and you have to learn what it is. You have to recognize what it is, recognize and understand, and then be able to label the actual emotion. Is it fear? Is it anxiety? Is it frustration? Being able to express your emotions, right? Mark Brackett, who's a director of the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence, has this really effective framework for thinking about your emotions,
mm-hmm.
and he calls it RULER, the RULER approach. It stands for recognize, understand, label, express, regulate. You need to recognize that you are having a certain mood. Or is your mood up, or is your mood down? Mm-hmm. Is your energy up, or is your energy down? And then start to ask yourself questions to better understand your mood. And then being able to label the emotion that you're feeling. Just by labeling the emotion and getting specific, you know, as to, because it's not just sad or happy, right? There are many emotions.
Yeah.
So being able to label the exact emotion that you're feeling helps to create distance between yourself and the emotion. So that's already you're already regulating the emotion. You're already by creating distance, right? And then being able to express that emotion, those thoughts, either via journaling or with somebody else, where you can talk to somebody else that you trust, and then finally regulating that emotion. And we have different techniques for that, different protocols, breathing techniques, paradigm shifting techniques, etc. But yeah, to answer your question, it's about getting comfortable with opening up and explaining exactly what it is that people are coming with anxiety about, you know, and understanding that that it's okay to feel anxiety. It's part of the process. Some anxiety is good. You can't eliminate or seek to eliminate the anxiety. You have to feel some anxiety, because anxiety helps you perform, helps you shine.
Yeah. So the distance that you're creating in that framework from the emotion itself, it's making me think about a therapy modality called internal family systems. Have you ever heard of it?
Yes, I've heard of it. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so internal family systems, I'm forgetting the psychologist or therapist who created it. It's about recognizing internally that there are different parts of you that feel different things. So the very common convention that we use is, oh, a part of me wants to do work, a part of me doesn't, a part of me in the morning wants to work out, but there's another part that, you know, definitely doesn't want to work out, doesn't want to put on the shoes, go to the gym, whatever it is, step outside and go for the jog. And by recognizing, hey, you don't have to be a psychotic person to feel like there are different parts of you, right? This isn't, you know, split personality disorder. This is just, hey, there's a section of my being that is not 100% in the action. And maybe that's because I'm tired. Maybe that's because, you know, one of those parts is stepping forward and wants to manage the situation because I'm feeling anxious. So I'm definitely not an expert at all at IFS. It's just a great way to create distance when you talk about, there's a part of me that is feeling really upset that this client didn't just say yes to my proposal. They're pushing back. And now I have to deal with that upsetness and sadness and perhaps anxiety of, what am I going to do now? How am I going to respond? So you're using this without even, you know, applying the framework, just because you are creating that distance to then feel it and talk about it and move through the emotion.
That's interesting. Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense, because, I mean, sometimes you're feeling confident about a situation. Other times you're feeling like you just want to cozy up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're a complex being, you know, there are different parts to us that act in different ways depending on the situation. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I understand that. That makes a lot of sense. IFS, right?
Yeah, internal family systems, yeah. The goofy, by the way, the goofy part of me is I refer to it, again, I don't have split personalities, but I refer to it as little Kyle. It's this young version of me where he's like 5-6 years old. And when he gets into arguments, or when rather I get into arguments with disagreements with my wife, he comes forward and he likes to smile. And I can't help sometimes but smile when I'm having a conflict because I'm like, okay, this is a way for me to manage my anxiety. I don't want to feel upset. Let's just smile through it. Everything's fine. And yeah. For me, I have a great visualization of it. Other people more hear voices or just understand that like there's a presence when you get really deep into IFS. But for me, I can picture them. I can't really hear them. And it's fun to play with that because that's 100% the goofy side of me. That's like, hey, let's just play. Let's just fool around. We don't need to be serious.
That's interesting. I think that provides a lot of clarity, too, as to why you do what you do, right? Like mm-hmm. you just said, the smiling that comes from when you're 5 or 6. And, yeah, I think there's so much power in just having awareness because... You know, you can't tame the monster if you don't shine a light on it, right? Yep. You have to be able to see that there's you tame it by shining a light on it, right? And that essentially means that you need to get clarity on a lot of things in the beginning to carve the path forward.
Yeah. If I could ask you a selfish question.
Yeah.
What sort of tools are you using from your professional world with your kids?
With my kids in terms of...
How to help them build resilience.
Yeah. So I have a boy who's going to be 6 this month and then my 2-year-old, right? So my 2-year-old, I think she's still a little too young. But my 6-year-old, you know, I'm already inculcating the importance of physical exercise. Mm-hmm. You know, he does engage in physical exercise. And then the most important thing, I think, or one of the most important things, is inculcating a growth mindset, right? That if you want to get to a certain objective, you need to put in effort, mm-hmm. right? You need to get feedback, you need to get the right resources, you need to practice and put in the reps. Mm-hmm. And over time, he starts to learn that, okay, I'm getting better. You know, like when he first started doing push-ups, for example, he could only do 3. Now he could do like 8 to 10.
Nice.
And he's building that self-confidence already. And you could see it in his eyes that he's starting to feel this self-pride, mm-hmm. you know. And also teaching him or making him aware that it's not about me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, I don't want him to work out to please me. It's not about pleasing me. It's not about pleasing his mom. It's not about pleasing his little sister. It's about pleasing himself so that he can feel the pride, right? And that's really important because if I don't do that, what I don't want to condition in him is that he has to do that to please me, mm-hmm. right? Or that my love is conditional.
Yeah.
That if he does that, I'm going to love him. No, it has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with my love to him. It has everything to do with him and building himself and building that self-esteem and self-trust that he can, you know, start doing difficult things and building that self-belief. Super important.
Yeah. Are there any parallels, and it's okay if the answer is no, are there any parallels that you have discovered between raising your son and daughter, although you're mentioning that she's a little young, raising them and then working with your clients?
Any parallels? When I see my son in his face and he completes, you know, like I have a routine for him, which is calisthenics. It's like 11 different exercises. And he started with just completing one set of each exercise. Now he's up to like 4 sets. He can do 4 sets. Mm-hmm. And seeing just as simple as that, you know, it's the face that he has in terms of building that self-belief and that pride, it's the same thing with adults, you know? And it's very simple. It's about engaging in certain training exercises, whether it's physical or the mental conditioning that we were just talking about, like the intentional embarrassment exercises. It's about putting in the reps and creating evidence, creating proof, so that you have those evidence-based thoughts when it's time to have your power statements and self-talk, that you actually have productive conversations with yourself and infuse the right thoughts, not just basis thoughts, but evidence-based thoughts, that you can do these things, right? And in that respect, the parallel is that it's just about the repetition, you know, whether you're a child or whether you're an adult, and creating that self-belief and that self-trust and that proof and that evidence that you can, that it's going to be okay, that you're going to get better.
Yeah. If somebody wanted to reach out to True Progress Lab, where is the best place for them to go?
So you can look for me at www.trueprogresslab.com, and I'm on most of the social media platforms, and I'm at True Progress Lab.
Okay. And if you could leave the audience with one question that they can ask themselves to help them level up, what would it be?
Think about how you are behaving vis-a-vis your job titles and what you do on a regular basis. Are you playing in the safe zone? Are you working in your comfort zone? Or maybe you can start thinking about ways to get outside your comfort zone and play a little bit so that you can start feeling this feeling of invigoration, this feeling of aliveness. Mm-hmm. Because if you want to feel that way, it comes from stepping outside your comfort zone.
Awesome. Thank you, Carlos.
Thank you, Kyle. Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to How You Level Up. If you're enjoying the show, subscribe and give a 5-star rating. There are new episodes each month asking questions about timeless communication lessons. Language is a medium for sharing, and the knowledge unpacked here can be applied to anyone, anywhere, facing any challenge. If there's a question or topic you'd like me to dive into next, send a note to any of my connected social media accounts. This is all about how you level up.